This is our last official talk of the day. And the way it's going to work now, Jo's going to speak to us on the whole war and religion subject. And then when she's done, we'll move into a Q&A with all three speakers. The way that that will work is I will ask the questions from down here. David has compiled them with Tom and with David, and I'll ask them. These guys will answer them. Is that all right? That's how we're going to go. And if you've enjoyed today, don't forget tomorrow morning will be even more exciting. So at all of our different meetings. But that's enough for me. It's just a chance to hand back to Jo. Let's give her a welcome again as she comes to speak to us.
Just to reassure you guys, I promise they're not just picking the easy questions. They're definitely going to go for the hard, edgy ones, so don't worry about that. Usually the slot after lunch is like the dead one, the one where everyone falls asleep, but we never have that problem when David is speaking. But we're going to have we're going to have a huge gear shift now, actually. So I'm sorry that it does feel like, okay, we're in sexuality and suddenly we're talking about warfare. But that's where we're going with this last session, and it may raise a lot more questions. So please, like they said, do keep sending them in. But I don't think any of you would accuse me of exaggerating when I say that we live in a world that is in crisis. And actually, it's a crisis that I think increasingly to many of us just feels closer and closer to home. In 2001, my father-in-law, who worked at the New York Stock Exchange, actually stood in horror as planes crashed into the two towers, and he was watching New Yorkers' colleagues jumping to their deaths from those buildings before the whole thing came crashing down. And in 2005, my brother, who was running slightly late for work, was on the tube heading towards Liverpool Street Station when the train ahead of him blew up. One of our students at Oka this year, Hassan, is a priest from northern Nigeria who was actually the person who first alerted the global media to the kidnapping of the 276 schoolgirls by the militant group Boko Haram. And he now consequently lives with a bounty on his head, and he's been shot at twice. A couple of months ago, Tom's parents were returning from a holiday in France only to find three Syrian refugees stowed away in their camper van once they arrived in Dover, who just went running off into the countryside. And then just last month, a bomb went off in Istanbul on the same street that one of our colleagues in this ministry lives on. That is the world that we live in today. It's a world of escalating violence, and a violence that actually leaves us feeling outraged and so frustrated at what we all perceive to be genuine evil. But more and more frequently these days, as people are searching for explanations for these kind of horrors, they immediately begin connecting the dots right back to religion as the cause. So consider Christopher Hitchens, who wrote the book God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Or what about the pianist who played the piano on the streets of Paris after those awful bombings in 2015? But you know, the song he chose to play was John Lennon's Imagine. And that is a song that dreams of a world with no religion too, when all the world will be as one. Is that the dream that everybody is seeking? Of course, very few questioners ever reflect on the fact that actually the bloodiest century in human history yet, the 20th century, actually wasn't primarily fueled by religious violence. Quite the opposite, in fact. In 1920, the communist leader, Lenin, commented that we do not believe in everlasting morality and we denounce all this lying rubbish about it. So spoke Lenin, and what was the legacy of his worldview? Over 100 million people have been killed by communist dictatorships since 1917. And in fact, the 20th century, which saw their atheistic, communist, and Nazi ideologies rise, saw more killing as a result of these than the previous 19 centuries put together. In his book, Not in God's Name, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who was chief rabbi in the UK, notes that the scholars who compiled a book called The Encyclopedia of Wars and looked into about 2,000 conflicts in human history actually only found that 10% of them involved religion at all, which I kind of found surprising, to be honest. The BBC did their own survey called the God and War Survey. They found that religion played something like 40% part in global conflicts. But even so, they said usually it's actually a minor role in conflict rather than a major one. But while it may be the case that acts of violence have less to do with religious belief in particular, and perhaps far more to do with the state of the human heart in general, this doesn't undermine the fact that atrocities have been and are still being committed in God's name all over the world. We only need to look back 1,000 years to our own Christian history of the Crusades to see the evidence of this. Or closer to home and even more recently, what about the bloody conflict of Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland? Are they not Christians? You know, what do these kind of events reveal to us and to the world about the true nature of Christianity? It's a tough question. My colleague Nabil Qureshi, who actually converted from being a devout Muslim to a Christian and who's recently written the best-selling book Answering Jihad, suggests that because as human beings we are governed by all sorts of motives, actually the true test of whether a religion is peaceful or not relies primarily not on what its contemporary followers do or don't do, because we all have mixed motives, but rather it relies on what the central historical figures or the sacred texts of a religion actually teach when you go back to their origins. It's all about going back to the source and looking at what does this religion really have to say about this. So in his book Answering Jihad, Nabil argues that this is why we find today such a stark split in our contemporary world between the typically peaceful millions of Muslims in the West, many of whom are our friends and people that we love, and then a radicalized Islam that is sweeping the Middle East and beyond through movements such as Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, and the Islamic State. For while in Islam, the word jihad, which literally means to struggle for something, is at times used in the Quran to convey a spiritual kind of struggle, at other times in the Quran, it is used to describe a literal physical warfare brought against those outside of Islam. So, for example, in the final portion of the Quran, which is considered Muhammad's last and therefore his most authoritative revelation from God, the Quran actually states that Muslims are to kill the polytheists, which actually includes Jews and Christians, because elsewhere in that chapter, we are accused of setting up other gods alongside Allah. So it says, kill the polytheists wherever you find them, lay siege to them, take them captive, and sit in ambush for them everywhere. If they convert to Islam, leave their way. March, whether heavy or light, and carry out jihad with your wealth and your lives in the way of Allah. That is good for you, if you only knew. Muhammad himself is recorded in the last decade of his life as having led 85 raids and battles. And that's actually found in the most reliable Islamic sources about his life, dating way back. Consequently, although these days imams in the West teach Muslims that the proper understanding of jihad is a spiritual battle rather than a physical one, it's on the basis of those earlier texts, as well as the example of the Prophet himself, that Islamic State based their propaganda upon these things. And it's through that kind of religious ideology that they are attempting to radicalize young Muslims. Because when you do return to the historical roots, you will find that warfare was a major component of the beginnings of Islam. So much so, in fact, that within 150 years from the beginning of Islam, Muslims had conquered 1/3 of the known world. But I think the challenge for us as Christians is whether our sacred texts are actually any different. After all, when we look at what Islamic State are doing in Syria today, and then we look at the way God commanded Israel to treat the Canaanites over 3,000 years ago, can we actually find any real difference? Can we, as Christians, claim to be a people of peace? Or do we find violence right at the heart of our faith as well? A few months ago, I was chatting to someone on a plane who, when I told him that I studied the Old Testament for my degree, he immediately responded, "You're kidding. You like all that fire and brimstone stuff?" But you know, it's hardly surprising that that has become the reputation of the God of the Bible when books by atheists like Richard Dawkins are bestsellers. So having spent some extensive time with a thesaurus, this is what Dawkins has to say. "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, a vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, a misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully." Tell us how you really feel, Richard. But what we're going to do now is we're going to spend some time looking at these warfare texts in the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, together now. However, before we do this, the first thing that I want to say is this, just a little caution, that when it comes to reading the Bible, and especially the Old Testament, we need to be so careful not to leap to conclusions. I discovered how important this was for myself the first time that I went to stay with my in-laws, who are Italian Americans living in New Jersey. And so I found myself sitting out back on the deck with my husband Vince's great uncle Big, and yes, he really is called Uncle Big, and when I heard these raised voices coming from inside the kitchen. And so I looked back through the window only to see Vince and his mom in what looked like the middle of an absolute screaming match. They were both bright red in the face. Their noses were like 1 inch away from each other, and their arms were gesticulating wildly. And what made it even more terrifying was actually Vince's mum had been chopping garlic in the kitchen, you know, making some meatballs as she does. And so she had this huge kitchen knife in her hand. And every time that she really wanted to make her point more emphatic, she'd be waving it around and suddenly she'd just point it right in Vince's face. And so there I was, sort of panicking, thinking World War III had broken out and wondering if I was going to have to run back in to break it up and maybe get skewered by the garlic knife in the process. Now, thankfully, things finally calmed down and Vince walked away. And so I went to find him because I was so concerned as I went to say, you know, hey, is everything all right with your mum? And Vince had no idea what I was talking about. And he reassured me that he and his mom were just having a perfectly enjoyable conversation. And so I said, well, hang on, what about the loud voices and the hands and the knife waving? And he just laughed and he said, Joe, that's just how Italians talk to each other. You know, I've completely misinterpreted the situation. What looked to me like a knife fight was in fact just two Italian Americans showing that they love each other. And you know, it shocked me that even as someone who'd grown up watching American television, who was used to traveling to other countries, and who even spoke the same language, well, supposedly anyway, I could still so badly misinterpret another culture. Now, my point is this. If I had that much trouble understanding Italian Americans living in New Jersey in the 21st century, how much more challenging should I expect to find understanding and interpreting ancient Near Eastern cultures from over 3,000 years ago? You know, when we step into the Old Testament, we're actually stepping into a wildly different world. It's a bloody world. It's full of conflict. It's tribal. It's messy. It's very foreign to us. And so when we do this, we just need to work really hard if we want to understand the cultural context of the text that we're reading. But when we do, if we actually take the time to do this properly, they begin to make so much more sense. When it comes to violence in the Old Testament, it's important that we situate this topic in the overall framework of the Bible, which begins with the startling statement that you'll all know in Genesis chapter 1. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created them. Now, in contrast to the oppressive cultures of the ancient world, these words of God in Genesis chapter 1 are absolutely paradigm shifting. They turn everything upside down by placing such a high value on every individual as an image bearer of God, and therefore not only equal before him, whether male or female, but actually of great value to him, great value. Consequently, any discussion about violence in the Old Testament needs to be framed with this original creation account that every life means something to God, a very great deal, in fact. Dawkins' accusation that the God of the Old Testament is a racist, genocidal tyrant and ethnic cleanser also jars strongly with the overarching vision of the biblical narrative that although we live in a fallen world now, we look forward to a future where we can live at peace, as Isaiah 2 puts it, a time when swords will be beaten into plowshares and there will be no more war. And looking towards that time, God promises Abraham that one day all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And here is how God commanded the Israelites to live out that promise in the meantime. It says this, the foreigner residing among you, we got it? This foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as you love yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. The call here is not to hate. The call is to love as you love yourself. But nevertheless, it's true that within the bloody, brutal context of the culture of the ancient Near East, we do find instructions for warfare in the Old Testament. But I wonder if Richard Dawkins knows that while other tribes frequently attacked the Israelites without warning, the Israelites were commanded by God to always offer their opponents the chance to surrender peacefully. And while in other nations, men were forcefully conscripted into the military, in Israel, men were excused from fighting if they were recently married, they just built a house, or if they simply didn't want to. It was also common practice in the ancient world to treat conquered victims with absolute ruthlessness and extreme forms of torture. For example, the Assyrians were famous throughout the ancient world for their use of torture. In contrast to this kind of treatment, in the Old Testament, we encounter a God who in Deuteronomy 20 actually commanded the Israelites to show mercy by leaving behind the fruit on the trees so that any survivors in the land would not starve. In the messy, bloody context of the ancient world, God gave laws for warfare that were intended to protect human life as far as possible. And when it came to the treatment of prisoners of war, although the standard practice in ancient warfare was to rape captive women, the Israelites were actually prohibited from this. So we're told in Deuteronomy 21, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife. After she's lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, then you may go to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. If you're not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes. You must not sell her or treat her as a slave, since you have dishonored her. Now, at first glance, this text makes for uncomfortable reading, doesn't it? It actually seems quite shocking to us on our first impressions. But actually, in that culture, what is it really saying? Well, firstly, that unlike in surrounding cultures where women were considered the spoils of war, rape is banned in Israel. Instead, if a man desires a foreign woman, he has to wait a full month until after the battle, both to ensure that he's not driven by short-term lust, but also to allow the woman to grieve her parents and her old life. And note that by only mentioning her parents, the text disqualifies a woman who is either already married or who's grieving the loss of a husband. And after a period of time, the man may take her as his partner, but only if he marries her. And in this way, the woman is actually welcomed into the Israelite community as a full, equal family member and is protected from becoming a slave on the margins. And finally, if he doesn't want her, he cannot sell her on as if she were property. He must set her free. In 2014, I was horrified to read in the news the pamphlet that Islamic State released to its soldiers giving guidelines for the treatment of female prisoners of war. The irony was that the Islamic State leaders composed this document to try and restrain the way that their soldiers were behaving towards the Yazidi and Christian women that they had taken captive. And yet, amongst other things, this pamphlet states that in accordance with the Quran, it is permissible for the soldiers to have sexual intercourse with a female captive immediately upon capture. She need not be taken as a wife, but only as a sexual slave. That it's permissible to sell her on or give her as a gift if the man doesn't want her. And most horrifyingly of all, that intercourse is permitted even if she's not yet reached puberty. You know, it's actually as I sat there reading that pamphlet with, to be honest, tears just streaming down my face, that I was struck by just how unbelievably compassionate the instructions actually are in Deuteronomy 21, because the two perspectives could not be more different. One is a clear case of a horrendous abuse of power, whereas actually the God of the Bible affords women every measure of protection in a hostile and broken world where it was exceptionally hard to survive as a single woman. But if the standards for warfare in ancient Israel in general are so much more advanced than the nations surrounding them, then what are we to make of the toughest passages? So, for example, the passage in Deuteronomy 20 that says, only in the cities of these people that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. This command to utterly destroy and kill everything that breathes is sometimes referred to as the ban, on the basis of the Hebrew word, which actually means to devote something to destruction or unto the Lord, connoting the idea of a holy war. Note that when God issues this extreme command, he actually does so within a very clear, rigid framework, with strict stipulations that the Israelites are to do this only against a particular peoples and only in very specific cities that the Lord is handing over. Why does that matter? Because it means that actually this kind of warfare can never be appropriate in any other kind of context. God allows this to occur at a very specific point in Israel's history for reasons that we shall come on to. But crucially, in doing so, God is not setting a precedent for us. By framing the commands in this way with clear boundaries, the Bible will not allow us to look back on these texts and use them as justification for any similar kind of warfare, either in our history or today, which means that when they did so during the Crusades, it was a violent abuse and misinterpretation of these original texts. But these commands are limited to a specific time, a specific place, specific peoples, and for a specific purpose. The second thing that I want to say about this text is this. Although at first appearances, this seems extremely black and white, actually, the picture that the Bible presents to us of what takes place in this warfare is actually both more complex and more checkered than we might initially assume when we quickly glance over the text. In particular, these rumors that we may have heard about the wholesale slaughter or genocide of the Canaanites turns out to be exactly that. Rumors. For example, in Joshua chapter 10, we're given the sweeping statement that Joshua struck all the land, the hill country, the lowlands and the slopes, and all of their kings, and he left no survivor, but he utterly destroyed all who breathed. And yet only a few chapters later, in chapter 15, we read of one of his commanders, Caleb, going on to further fight and kill more people in the very same countryside where we've just been told there's been no one left alive. Those people are supposed to be already destroyed if we're reading this rightly. Other texts confirm that it's a more complicated picture going on, as despite these claims to have destroyed everyone, Judges 1:27, amongst others, states that they did not drive them out completely. And notice that actually this language of driving out, which is frequently used in the Old Testament alongside this command to kill everyone that breathes, is actually very, very telling, because the language of driving out actually implies that the fate of many of the Canaanites was exile rather than death. I know that when I first heard the rumors of these supposedly indefensible passages in the Old Testament, what bothered me the most was all of the civilians that must have been killed. Now, I just thought this seems so unfair. But here too, we find the biblical account to be much more complicated than our memories of Sunday school may have perhaps led us to believe. Take the Battle of Jericho as just one example. Jericho is often cited as a case of genocidal activity, as we're told everyone in the city was killed, men and women, young and old. And yet, in actual fact, archaeological evidence suggests that rather than being a bustling civilian city, Jericho was actually a fairly small military outpost. Indeed, it's precisely because Jericho is not enormous that the army can actually walk around it seven times in one day. As a military fort, it would also have been filled almost entirely by combatants rather than civilians. And notably, the only civilian who we're really told is present is Rahab. And she's not only saved from the destruction along with her household, but she even becomes part of the bloodline of Christ and is counted in the book of Hebrews as a woman of great faith. That's just one example. We could look at many others. But given these and other biblical details about the Canaanite conquest, scholars who've really looked into this have actually suggested that rather than this being a wholesale command or slaughter, that the instruction to kill everything that breathes is better read as a military idiom, as military rhetoric. It's similar to the way that, as someone who's married to a baseball fan, I might say the Yankees slaughtered the Red Sox in that game last night. It was total carnage. Did the Yankees slaughter them? Yes, it's actually a true statement in the way that we use language. But I don't literally mean that the Yankees were going to be thrown in jail for the first degree murder of the Red Sox. This is a way that we often use language. It's called hyperbole. And in a similar way, archaeologists have uncovered a statement from Ramesses II of Egypt, who actually claims that he wiped out the whole nation of Israel in the 13th century. As he says, Israel is wasted, his seed is no more. Yet obviously we know that's not actually the case. That didn't actually happen. Instead, this is an example of the kind of military rhetoric that was common in the ancient world. Taken together, what all the biblical evidence actually suggests is that while Israel's victory was decisive, it wasn't a war of total annihilation. Now, of course, none of this evidence takes away from the fact that God did command the Israelites to go to war against these people. And nor is there, I think, getting around the fact that actually war is always horrendous. And yet, according to the Bible, this was a justified war, a war that God intended as an act of justice. Now, I think for many people, the severity of the judgment of Canaan through warfare, to us from our 21st century perspective, it may seem disproportionate. We struggle, I think, to see the justice in it. But that may be because we can't fully comprehend just how problematic Canaanite society had actually become. A few weeks ago, I heard uncontrollable laughter coming from the other room in our flat. So I went to find Vince reading this article from the Oxford Mail, our local newspaper. Concern as 7-inch hole appears in the street. That was the headline. You can see the accompanying picture. And the article read, a hole measuring 7 inches wide has appeared in Hillary Way. Resident Helen Wright, 35, said the hole started out the size of a 50p coin, but it's now a big problem since we have many children living around here. Hopefully this issue will be fixed soon. Oxfordshire County Council spokeswoman Emily Reed said the council aimed to get the hole filled by tonight. Now, for those of us who live in sheltered places like Oxford, where a 7-inch hole in the road is counted as a big problem, we actually, I think, can't even conceive of just how deplorable Canaanite culture might have become. It's a culture known for bestiality, for incest and adultery, a culture that prostituted its own children, who consistently assaulted the Israelites and who preyed on their most vulnerable. They worshipped a goddess called Anat. She was the goddess of sex and war, who's described in Canaanite mythology as wading in blood so deep that it came up to her neck. Under her feet were human heads. Above her, human hands flew like locusts. Her liver swelled with laughter. Her heart was full of joy. And this was a people so depraved that as part of their worship, they even sacrificed their own children in the fire to the god Molech. And archaeologists have actually found the child remains of thousands of child sacrificers in the Phoenician city of Carthage who worshipped the very same Canaanite gods. During my conversation with that agnostic stranger on the plane, he brought up the atrocities that Islamic State had been committing in Syria. And then to my surprise, he said this, I suppose when it comes to justice, I'm a bit Old Testament. Sometimes our society can be so wishy-washy, but we have to open our eyes to the fact that evil is real. And this reminded me of what the Yale theologian Miroslav Volf wrote after the massacre of his own people in Yugoslavia. He says this, although I used to complain against the indecency of God's wrath, I came to realize that I'd have to rebel against a God who wasn't wrathful at the sight of the world's evil. God isn't wrathful in spite of being love. God is wrathful because God is love. If God didn't judge the perpetrators of evil, then we would have to wonder whether he actually cares about the victims of evil. Because actually, when you love somebody, you cannot stand to see them hurt and not do anything about it when they've been mistreated and wronged. And actually, I want to suggest that it's because of the love that God has not only for the Israelites, but actually for every one of those sacrificed children that the Canaanites had to be judged. And yet, even to the Canaanites, God remains slow to anger and abounding in love. A God who takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked. Instead, this is a God who holds off judgment for 400 years, we're told in Genesis chapter 15, in the hope that the Canaanites would turn and be saved. Just as this is a God who in Christ was ultimately willing to be judged himself so that he could hold off our judgment, not just for 400 years, but actually for all eternity. And crucially, For Christians, the final and ultimate word of the Bible on violence is not found in these ancient texts that actually only applied in the most unique and very specific of circumstances in the face of horrendous evil. But actually, we find our ethic on violence in the incarnate word of God himself, the word made flesh, Jesus, who is the full revelation of God to us. As such, it is Christ who is our role model, and he is the one who shows us how to live, which is a challenge to us, because as a Prince of Peace, Christ's teaching on violence is absolutely radical. He's the one who not only preaches that Christians must turn the other cheek in the face of violence, that we must love our enemies and actually pray for those who persecute us. But he himself even lived this out in the most radical and extraordinary of ways. So that when they come against him with violence, it's Jesus who tells Peter to put away his sword and who goes willingly with his captors. You know, even in Islam, the founder of the faith leads his people in battle. And yet Jesus never once picked up a weapon except to tell Peter to put it down. As Napoleon Bonaparte once commented, "I know men, and I tell you that Jesus Christ is no mere man. Between him and every person in the world, there is no possible term of comparison. Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and I have founded empires. But on what did we rest the creations of our genius? Upon force. Jesus Christ founded his empire upon love. And at this hour, millions of men would die for him." It's a startling truth that actually we really do find violence at the very heart of the Christian faith. And yet, this is not a violence done to humanity by God, but rather a violence done to God by humanity. In Christianity, we don't find a God who is vindictive or violent, but a God who willingly becomes victim. For while the Canaanite goddess Anat glories in shedding the blood of her enemies, the Christian God has his blood shed while praying for his enemies. "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." And as those whom Christ has called to take up our crosses and follow after him, the way forward for us as Christians in this world in crisis that we're living in should actually be clear. Because we too are called not to cause the death of others, but rather to lay down our lives on their behalf. And given the war-torn and broken state of the world that we live in, I want to briefly suggest to you two ways that we as Christians can and should be responding to war and violence. And I think the first is that we need to be people who care for the persecuted. I was reading last year about Lord Weidenfeld, who's a British Jewish peer who rescued over 2,000 Syrian Christians who were being persecuted. And he says that he did so because he himself was rescued by British Christians from the Nazis during the Second World War. And so out of his own effort and expense and a lot of political effort as well, he wanted to repay that favor, and he did. But I was also really struck by his comments as he observed that he actually couldn't understand why Christians themselves weren't doing more to rescue persecuted Christians in the Middle East. And he wondered why the church in our country seemed to be so asleep on the issue, and why we didn't seem to care more about the oppression of our own people. Another Jew, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs again, has commented that a century ago, Christians made up 20% of the population in the Middle East, whereas today they make up 4%. As he comments, what's happening is the religious equivalent of ethnic cleansing. It's one of the crimes against humanity of our time. Did you know that today Christians are the most persecuted people group in the whole world? But what are we, as Christians who are pretty safe in the West, doing to help our Christian brothers and sisters around the world? Do we even remember to pray for them? How are we going to be family to them? And as a second response, I want to suggest that we need to be people who ourselves build bridges of peace. One of our students this year, I told you about Hassan at the beginning, who's a Nigerian priest from Jos, which is right at the heart of Boko Haram territory in northern Nigeria. And Hassan has this bounty on his head. Why? because he's committed to actually bringing change to his community and his region. Hassan looked at the situation he's living in, where churches were being blown up and whole villages of Christians were being slaughtered and girls were being kidnapped and forcefully married or raped. And Hassan thought, how can I get the Muslims and the Christians to be at peace with one another? And so first he went to the Muslim imam in the area and he began meeting with him once a week, asking him to teach him about the Islamic view of Jesus, asking good questions, starting a conversation. And then Hassan saw a Muslim little girl playing in the street one day when she should have been in school. And so Hassan asked her, why are you not at school? And she replied, oh, my parents can't afford it. And so he said, well, that's not right. Let me see what I can do. Long story short, and a year on, but now 260 Muslim children are getting a free education in the church schools in that district. And then after 6 months or so, Hassan said to these Muslim leaders, hey, I've noticed that your women are really, really skilled with needlework in a way that our women aren't. Whereas our women know all about cooking a certain way that your women don't. So why don't we get our women together and have them train and teach one another? Initially, that suggestion was met with some suspicion, but over a year, the group has grown from 6 members to over 200 women from both communities meeting together every single week. And finally, just before Hassan left to come and study in Oxford for the year, actually the militant Muslim youth in the area, who were members of Boko Haram, came to see him. And as he saw them coming to his door, where his family were, you can just imagine what he was thinking as this gang of youths came down the street. This is it. They've come to kill me. They've come to collect the bounty. But then the youth stopped outside his door. And then they said to him, hey, it's not fair. You're doing all these things for our children. You're doing all these things for the women. But what are you going to do for us? How amazing is that? The local Boko Haram militants basically coming to an Anglican priest and asking him to find a way to include them in his mission strategy. No, it's the most extraordinary and dangerous of circumstances. And yet Hassan is one Christian who's committed to finding ways of building bridges of peace. Now, we live in different communities. But what bridges of peace might God be calling us to build? Where is the violence and brokenness in our community? How can we respond to that today? Who has God called you to love and serve, even in the face of open hostility? Who is your neighbor? Who is God asking us to pray over? Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. And just as we finish this afternoon, before we move into a time of Q&A, I just want to issue this final invitation, because it may just be here today that actually some of you, you know yourselves that you actually haven't been living at peace with God. You've been at war. Maybe you're battling issues to do with Christianity. Maybe you're questioning God's character. Can he really be good, morally good? Is he really for me? Does he really love me? Does he care about the victims, about injustice? Does he even exist? But maybe today you feel like actually you want to lay those weapons down and you don't want to be at odds with God anymore. It was St. Augustine who said, you've made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. Do you want to be at peace today? It may be that you've been a Christian, but this has been a long-term doubt and struggle for you. And you want that reconciliation. And maybe some of you here have actually never been a Christian, but today you're thinking, gosh, if this is really what's on offer, if God is really that for me, if he loves me that much, no matter what I've done or what I ever will do. If that's how you're feeling today and you want to be reconciled to God, then I'm just going to pray now. And I just invite you to pray with me. Just repeat after me in your hearts. And then afterwards, we'll go into some Q&A. Loving Father, I thank you that you're a God who made us in your image and who sees every single one of us as your children, no matter how far we've wandered or what we may have done. I thank you that you're not a God who stayed at a distance, but a God who came to preach peace to both those who are far off and those who are near. I thank you that you see clearly into our hearts today, that you see our unrest, you see our turmoil, our struggle, the places where we've been battling and doubting and afraid. And God, we're so sorry for the ways that we've pushed you away and treated you with suspicion or made you into the enemy. But I thank you that you're a God of love, a God who would love us even in the face of our hostility, and who would willingly take on all of our rebellion and take on all of that violence and that sin, and you would give your life and your love to us in its place. Please would you forgive us today? And would you bring us back into relationship with you if we've been far off? The relationship that you made us for before we even ever took our first steps and our first breath. Amen.